Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Nice to have you tuned in today. I'm Neil Stavem. Ken Ross at controls, Carissa's at the phones. And Ted, tell me if this doesn't sound like a good summary of what many people believe, particularly those who consider Christianity and maybe all religious beliefs as irrelevant and unreasonable. Atheism, the belief that there was once absolutely nothing and nothing happened to the nothing until the nothing magically exploded for no reason, creating everything and everywhere. And then a bunch of the exploded everything magically rearranged itself, for no reason whatsoever, into self-replicating bits that then turned into dinosaurs.
Yeah, that's incredible. It's been said that it takes a lot more faith to be an atheist than a Christian sometimes.
Well,
it
does, you know, and that view maybe doesn't, I mean, what that view doesn't answer, of course, is those important questions like, you know, origin and meaning and morality and destiny. Well, what if in the next 45 minutes you could get answers to those questions and be better equipped to engage in faith conversations? That would be a plus, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We've got that. Today is your day. We've got that coming in just a moment. We're going to talk with one of the apologists and speakers of Ravi Zacharias' international ministry team, co-author with Ravi of a brand new book called Jesus Among Secular Gods, The Countercultural Claims of Christ. And that's just ahead. Looking forward to that. But first, I do want to mention Happy Valentine's Day, by the way.
Yes,
and want to mention our Valentine's Day drawing. It's on our Connecting Faith show page. You need to sign up online, myfaithradio.com, and then click on the Connecting Faith show page, and you'll see a sign-up opportunity for the DVD Priceless.
Oh, the song by Four King and Country, you know that
right,
song?
Right, yeah, that's the setting for this story, and it's a powerful video.
Yeah.
We've got six copies to give away, and you can sign up today. We'll draw the winners tomorrow. But so go to myfaithradio.com, click on the Connecting Faith show page, and sign up for one of those DVDs. Priceless, the movie, just came out. It's, in fact, releasing today, Valentine's Day. So we've got some copies to give away, and want to make sure you get one.
And when's the drawing actually taking place again?
We'll do it tomorrow.
Tomorrow, you said. Okay,
yeah.
Very good.
When the Valentine's candy is half off.
There you go. All about saving the money.
I don't think that works for postage for us.
Anyway. Yeah, right.
All right. Well, let's get to today's conversation. Really looking forward to welcoming back Dr. Vince Vitale back to Connecting Faith. And last time we talked, he was in Oxford. He's since relocated to their main campus, Ravi Zacharias International Ministries campus in Atlanta area. He's the director of the Zacharias Institute. Vince was educated at the University of at Princeton University and the University of Oxford, and he's taught philosophy of religion as a faculty member of both universities, and written several books and speaks a lot on issues like the problem of evil. And, in fact, he's a co-author with Ravi, his previous book, Why Suffering? And then we talked to him about that. And we're looking forward to finding out more about Jesus Among Secular Gods, The Countercultural Claims of Christ. Vince, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Thanks, Neil. Great to be on with you guys.
You know, I just, before we kind of dive into this topic, I know that seeing Ravi's newsletters and updates, I know that Ravi and Abdul Murray, also on your team, were just, I think, last week at University of Michigan and Michigan State University and had thousands attending for these kind of Ask Anything sessions. And I know you've done a lot of campus kind of events like that. Is this a common that's on campuses today that people are coming out in droves to talk about real issues?
It is. It's incredibly encouraging. Like you said, University of Michigan and Michigan State, I think there were 3,500 and 9,500 people, many of whom students at these events, and just incredibly encouraging to see the questions. You know, Oxford English Dictionary made post-truth their word of the year for 2016. And as we were going through the election here in America, The Economist wrote an article that was circulated very widely talking about us living in a post-truth society. And I just think, you know, as we move increasingly towards a post-truth society, you know, God has set in our hearts that desire for truth. And so people are not having outlets to ask their questions, but there's something in them that wants to ask the questions. People are actually tweeting during the second of those events, the larger of the events, and I believe Michigan and Michigan State were playing each other in basketball, and they were saying, this is the thinnest crowd that we've seen for this game ever. And somebody tweeted back and said, I think it's because so many people are at the Ravi Zacharias event. Wow.
That's wonderful, and just another reason why standing with your ministry and support and prayer is so vital, because you guys are really doing frontline work. I mean, maybe you encounter, but it just, you know, on the surface, it does make one wonder sometimes, are students really, do they understand much of anything at all in terms of, you know, worldview or being able to frame some of those big questions? You know, if you only watch the news and the protests, you think, well, you know, higher education may be lacking a bit.
Yeah, I mean, you get to college and there's so many options in front of you. That's partly why we wrote this book, Jesus Among Secular Gods. Ravi had done Jesus Among Other Gods, and the publisher actually came to us and said, you know, now there's so many secular ways of seeing the world out there. We need to do another book with Jesus Among Secular Gods, because people get to college. They have so many different options in front of them, and they're being told that to choose one of the options and to imply that that was better than another option, well, you'd be immediately branded as narrow-minded and intolerant. So, you know, it's a recipe for not seeking the truth. You're paralyzed by the choice. You're told to even make a choice is to be narrow-minded and intolerant. It's an impossible task.
Mm. You know, this new book, Jesus Among Secular Gods, The Countercultural Claims of Christ. By the way, we do have a copy to give away. I want to just let you know about that. You're going to want to sign up for that, written by Dr. Vince Vitale and Dr. Ravi Zacharias. And you can call us at 877-933-2484 to get your name in the drawing. Hope that you'll do that. And we'll do that drawing here at the top of the hour, 877-93-FAITH. You may have a question or a comment as well for our conversation. You're welcome to join in. Is there it seems like there's a couple camps probably. There's those that are, you know, are intolerant and, you know, disrespect and maybe even hate Christianity. But then there's maybe the other side that says, well, it's irrelevant. It doesn't really matter. Is there one side or the other that seems to have more sway today?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I always think the irrelevant. I can deal with people who have serious objections to Christianity, who even are antagonistic towards Christianity. We often find with that sort of emotion, actually, you can get to the deeper questions because you think to yourself, why is there so much emotion here? Why are you so angry at a God who you don't think exists? And sometimes it's only a small step from there to get to talking about meaningful things. But when it's just that it's people see it as irrelevant or they're just indifferent, I think that's the most dangerous of the situations. And so many people are in that place. You know, we called the book Jesus Among Secular Gods because everyone has something at the center of their life. Everyone has something which is setting the trajectory of their lives, whether they realize it or not. And I think the dangerous thing is that so many people just fall into some belief system, some habit, some way of living, and you just set yourself on a trajectory without ever making a decision about it. And decades from now, you find yourself as someone who you don't even recognize. So, you know, what we wanted to do with this book was carve out some space to say, let's take a respectful, informed look at all the different options and help people to make a real choice about that.
You talk about the isms, and we'll kind of touch on some as we go along, but are they really religious in nature? Is that a designation? I mean, if you were to say to someone that, well, your belief in scientism or pluralism or humanism is actually a religion, they would probably push back on that.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, religion, the term has been used in so many different ways. But I think what we can say is that there's going to be some principle or some belief or some assumption or some way of acting that's going to set that trajectory for your life. That's true for every single person. And, you know, there are steps of faith in every way of seeing the world. Scientism doesn't explain itself. Science doesn't explain itself. Why should we think that the universe is going to carry on in the regular way that it always has. Somebody might say, well, that's the way it always has carried on. But that's not an answer to the question. That's the question itself. Why has the universe always operated with regularity, and why will it continue to do so tomorrow? There's an infinite number of different strengths that gravity could take. Science doesn't give you a scientific answer to why science operates with regularity. The actual foundation for all of science. I think that Christianity gives an answer to that question. If you have a God who created the universe and desires for people to live coherent lives in which they can find meaning in, well, then you have a basis for science, because you have a basis for why the universe itself would be regular. So, you know, I actually think in science you take a blind leap of faith. I think in Christianity you take a grounded step of faith. I know in my own story, as I began to look into Christianity, there was so much for me to grab onto historically, scientifically, philosophically, morally, in order to say that this is a grounded and rational step, and you take that step of faith, and then you continue to take additional steps of faith as you begin to walk alongside God.
You know, I think we'll take a quick break, because I want to come back and let you just tell a little bit about your story, because I think people can, it will be encouraging to know that this was not something that you were, you weren't predisposed perhaps to pursue Christianity, but you were studying philosophy, and you discovered the reality of faith, and we want to help all of us better effectively communicate it to those that believe other things. We're talking Jesus Among Secular Gods, the Countercultural Claims of Christ. And we're going to get to more in just a moment with Dr. Vince Vitale, who's the director of the Zacharias Institute. He's part of the apologetics team at Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. Our phone number is 877-933-2484 if you'd like a copy of this new book from Ravi and Vince. And we'll talk more with Vince in just a moment. Well, that's what we believe, but many today present serious challenges to the absolute claims of Christ. And the Christian worldview has been devalued or dismissed or ridiculed, perhaps. And we're talking about it today with Dr. Vince Vitale, who's director of the Zacharias Institute, serves alongside Ravi Zacharias in his international ministries, and he's co-written a new book with Ravi called Jesus Among Secular Gods, the Countercultural Claims of Christ. Vince was educated at Princeton University and the University of Oxford, and while you were at Princeton, that bastion of Christian faith, you ended up kind of taking a spiritual journey. Vince, tell us a bit about your story.
Yeah, that's right. It's a surprising story, and certainly not one that I expected. I showed up at Princeton. I was playing soccer at the time, and there were two guys who were a year older than me on the soccer team, and they invited me to a meeting called Athletes in Action, and I was interested enough in the athletic part of it to go along. I was from a culturally Catholic background, not practicing, not church-going. But if you had asked me, are you a Christian, I think I would have said, well, I'm an Italian-American from New Jersey, therefore Catholic, therefore Christian. And I got to this meeting, and I can remember seeing other students who otherwise seemed like the sort of people that I would hang out with, and they were singing their hearts out to this invisible God. And I can remember thinking to myself, whatever these people mean when they say I'm a Christian, and whatever I mean when I say, well, I'm a Catholic, therefore a Christian, are two different things. And that was a really significant moment for me. It sort of started my search for God. Maybe I knew some things about God, but I recognized in that moment that I didn't know God himself. And so my journey started there. I started to ask a lot of hard questions, and I was incredibly blessed to have a community that took my questions seriously, didn't make me feel bad for asking them. I began to read the Bible, and to be honest, my first time through, I would add things, I would cross things out, I'd write words in the margins that I don't use anymore, but at the same time, I was falling in love with the person of Jesus as I continued to read, and I began to look into the defenses of the Christian faith, found myself blown away. I couldn't believe you could actually study these things, and there could be reasons, good reasons, to believe in God. And for me, one of the most significant ones was thinking about the resurrection of Jesus and thinking about that historically. I mean, if you look in your Bibles later in the first few verses of 1 Corinthians 15, where it talks about all the appearances of Jesus to people after he had clearly been killed, even the most skeptical scholars now date that creed that's part of that letter to the first couple of years after Jesus' death. And that means that it simply couldn't have developed as a legend. That theory gets completely blown out of the water. And so you have to ask the question, how could it be the case that all of these people, the text says hundreds of people, are walking around utterly convinced that they've seen this man after he's clearly died, and they're so convinced of it that they're willing to give their lives for it because they're being persecuted for it? That's a huge historical gap. Now, a Christian fills that gap with the resurrection. I think criticism without alternative is empty. If you don't fill that gap with the resurrection, what do you fill it with? And I don't think there's any other good answer. I arranged meetings with the two top New Testament professors at Princeton at the time to say, look, I'm looking into this. I see how the resurrection explains the history. I don't know what the other alternatives are. What are your alternatives? These were both non-Christian professors, and one of them glanced towards a mass hallucination theory that's riddled with problems and has not earned any credibility in the literature. The other one told me that he's simply not interested in the question as a historian. There seemed to be some sort of assumption that as soon as we begin talking about the miraculous, we're no longer talking about history, and I've never understood why he thought that. So that's part of my journey, the intellect needed to clear some obstacles out of the way. My mind was, in a sense, the guardian of my heart, and when those intellectual obstacles were cleared out of the way, then there was a clear path for me to consider Jesus, for him to bring conviction in terms of the sin in my own life, and for me to respond to him in terms of a desire for a relationship with him.
And you have the opportunity to see that story kind of replicated time and time again through your work today, so we're so thankful that you and the team at Ravi's ministry are so effective at that. I'm just wondering, you know, just it makes me wonder, you know, the professor who wasn't interested in the question. I mean, it does seem like if we sort of start with the premise that maybe there is no God, then, I mean, there are some big questions that aren't getting answered, are they, or not getting answered very effectively?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, if you start with the assumption that there could never be a miracle, then of course you're going to come to the conclusion that a miracle didn't happen. But I don't think that's intellectually honest to come to the table with that as your starting point. One of the questions that I love to ask people is, have you ever experienced anything that has made you think there might be a God? And if you actually wait through the few seconds of awkward pause before you get an answer, you will hear the most remarkable things from people that have God's fingerprints all over them. And you listen to these stories and you say, that has happened to you and you don't believe in God? It's amazing. But you said it well earlier, Neil, you know, the things that don't get explained if you take God out of the picture, origin, meaning, morality, destiny. I mean, imagine showing up into a game and you're asked to play this game and you don't know when it started, you don't know when it is going to finish, you don't know what the rules are or what the purpose of the game is. And then you start asking the other players to fill you in on these questions and they all give you different answers. So then you try to find the referee or the umpire in the game, and it turns out the players have sent him home because they didn't like his answers to the questions. It would become a completely meaningless endeavor, and a lot of people are in that situation. Origin, meaning, morality, destiny. Where do we come from? Where are we headed? What's our purpose in life, and therefore how should we live in light of that? Every single person needs to answer that question in order to live a coherent life. And as I said before, criticism without alternative is empty. It's one thing to criticize Christianity's answers to those questions, but if you can't put anything in that place, then you're not in a position to live a meaningful life.
If you peel back some of the layers, as you talk about in your book, of Jesus among secular gods, and we're talking about various isms like atheism or scientism or pluralism or humanism and on it goes, I'm wondering, is there maybe a kind of a correlation between the development of these or the strength of these and that there's a rejection of hell and judgment, that we've sort of gravitated to this because it keeps us from facing the possibility that God is just or judge?
I think that's true. I think that's true. If there's no clear truth, as many of these isms say, about the matters of right and wrong, then there's no need for forgiveness. And if there's no need for forgiveness, then Jesus as Savior doesn't make any sense. And not only does he not make sense then, but he actually becomes offensive. When someone walks up to you and says they forgive you when you haven't done anything wrong, that's actually offensive, and we're seeing that in culture. You know, if we are just the products of a naturalistic, atheistic, random biology, then as Richard Dawkins puts it, there's no evil and there's no good. Then the things we call evil are simply things we don't like, but they're things we were made for, just to do anything that we can to survive. Ethics is just an illusion. And, you know, why should we then be rebuked for murdering someone any more than a wild animal should be rebuked for killing another animal? I think the reality is, if we're honest with ourselves and we're willing to ask those deep questions of the heart, that we severely underestimate the reality of our sin and our wrongdoing in life. For me, there was a moment when, several years after I became a Christian, I received news that someone who I can remember being very unkind to, I can remember taking opportunities to push down, had taken his life. And you know how the Bible says, for the wages of sin is death. And I had, by that point, read that verse dozens of times, and I think the reality of it had never truly hit me until I was forced to see the ripple effects of my sin in the lives of others. So often we don't see those ripple effects. What if we had God's perspective and we were able to see all of the ripple effects of all of my unkind words over the years? You know, I was forced to come to the conclusion that I am undoubtedly in need of a Savior. But I think that when we try to rationalize away our sin, when we try to say we don't have a problem with forgiveness, then we can get rid of God, and we can just say, like many of the isms do, that it's up to us. We'll try to create perfection ourselves rather than relying on a perfect God who we need to come down and to provide for us.
Dr. Vince Vitale is my guest today. Vince studied at Princeton University and the University of Oxford, and he later taught philosophy of religion as a faculty member of both universities. He is now director of the Zacharias Institute. He's been an apologist and a speaker, a teacher with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, one of their team, and he has written a number of things. In fact, while at Oxford, developed a new response to the problem of evil, and that response, termed the non-identity defense, is discussed in Ravi's book called Why Suffering. He and Ravi have co-authored a brand new book called Jesus Among Secular Gods, The Countercultural Claims of Christ. So if you know someone who is steeped in atheism, or maybe it's humanism or relativism or hedonism, those things, you will find some practical, helpful answers in this book. And we do have a copy to give away. I want to encourage you to sign up for that. We'll do a drawing here at the top of the hour. You call 877-93-FAITH. Put your name in the drawing for that, 877-933-2484. And coming up in a moment here after the break, we'll talk about the idea that maybe it's just presumptuous that we can know answers to questions. And I'll talk a little bit about science and also, you know, maybe are all religions basically the same? Maybe you've heard that argument. We'll talk about that false assumption and more. Love to have you join the conversation, too, if you have a question or comment or just want to sign up for a copy of the book. More with Dr. Vince Vitale in a moment. You can call 877-933-2484. Affirming our beliefs, but also how to engage others. Maybe you know someone who's a seeker or a skeptic, and you want to just be able to have faith conversations. Talk about the claims of Christ, and they are exclusive, and that bothers many. We're talking about it today, getting some good insight from Dr. Vince Vitale, who's director of the Zacharias Institute, part of the Ravi Zacharias International Ministries team of apologists. And he's a co-author with Ravi, a new book called Jesus Among Secular Gods. Vince, I'm just curious to know, maybe, is the idea that sort of the presumption that we could actually know answers to our questions on science or anything, these other isms, is that, you know, kind of a new idea that maybe we can't actually know? I mean, I don't know if that was the case when you were in school. Was it, yes, there are things that we can know if we just pursue it, but we're kind of in this postmodern era now where has things changed to even pursue these questions?
That's probably true, and probably increasingly so, and it sort of it makes sense. If you take God out of the picture, then you're in a tough position in terms of having confidence that you can pursue the truth. So in some way there, I'd want to affirm some of these isms, pluralism, relativism, and say, you know, that intuition that, you know, if you take God out of the picture, actually we shouldn't have confidence in our findings of truth. And maybe that's something that, that we can affirm. And I think that's probably the case. Sometimes I ask people to draw a circle that represents the totality of their knowledge about the universe, and then to try to draw a circle around that circle, which includes the totality of all that's to be known in the universe. I mean, that would be the smallest of fractions. And even as you said, when you think about science, the vast, vast majority of scientific theories that at one point were considered true as a consensus have now been overturned and shown to be false. That doesn't mean that there aren't elements of truth that are passed on, but most, it's a reality that most scientific theories considered true through time have now been considered false. So if we're just, you know, down to ourselves, if it's just a humanism type of situation where we are all we have to rely on in terms of finding the truth, I don't think we're in position to really think that we can be very confident about that. So, you know, oftentimes Christianity is branded as arrogant or exclusive in that respect. But I think, you know, if we're pursuing our faith in the right sort of way, it should be quite a humble position to say that when it comes to seeking the truth, we're only really in position to have confidence about that if somebody a lot bigger than us and a lot smarter than us is willing to reveal that truth to us.
You know, as speaking about Christianity, that, you know, we need to be humble about it. And yet many would say, well, Christianity, it's all religions are basically the same. Talk about, you address that false assumption in the book as well.
Yeah, that's right. And we need to talk about this charitably. We need to talk about it lovingly, but we do need to talk about it because it's just amazing the number of people. I met someone on the street a few weeks ago, and she said, I think religion's a good thing. I think all religion's the same. Now, some people say, I think religion's a bad thing, but they'd also probably say, I think all religions are the same. And it's really not the case when you actually take the time to look into them. You know, sometimes people think that religions are superficially different. They're fundamentally the same. It's actually quite the opposite when you start to study them. Sometimes they're superficially similar, but actually they're fundamentally different. And Christianity and Islam is a perfect example of this. Considerable differences. I mean, perhaps the most important one, when you just think of the way that Allah is depicted in terms of a loving nature and the way that the Christian God is depicted in terms of a loving nature. If you read through the Quran, time and time again, you will read about people that Allah hates. Allah loves those who are obedient to him, those who believe what he wants them to believe, but it's clear that he hates those who are disobedient and those who have different beliefs. There's one verse in the Quran, one surah in the Quran that says Allah hates the prodigal. That really jumped out at me. Wait, Allah hates the prodigal son, the same type of prodigal son that the Christian God is depicted. Jesus depicts the father as just taking off running like an embarrassing fool when he sees the son off on the horizon and embracing him and kissing him and giving him the family robe and the ring and the sandals on his feet and throwing him a huge party. It's a radically different understanding of the nature of God. And that idea of while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. While we were still against him in belief and in behavior, God was willing to come down and give his life for us. That's an unconditional love that you don't find in any of the other major religions.
Of course, I think as you address too, the three almost cornerstone, I guess, premises of our faith, right, that Jesus was God, man, that he died, and then he rose again. All those three are completely antithesis for what Islam practices, right?
That's right, and one way to say it is precisely the things that you need to believe in order to be a Christian are precisely the things that it's anathema to believe in a Quranic context. So oftentimes there's actually opposite claims being made, not just slight differences.
So we have these false assumptions. We also are, you know, face pressure, it seems, to at least maybe more so just in the last few months, to not be disagreeable. Right? I mean, that, you know, we can believe things, but that all ideas are equal value. I guess maybe that's what's behind that.
Yeah, that's right. There was one Harvard student who said, I'm allowed to claim anything that I want as long as I don't claim that I believe it. And I think this is part of what's going on in that situation. There's this trajectory of truth that people are worried about, where you make a truth claim, and then that causes you to disagree with another person. And people are afraid that once you start to disagree with another person, that will inevitably lead to the devaluing of the other person. And that will lead to intolerance of the other person, and that will lead to extremism, and then to violence, and ultimately to terrorism. And if that's the trajectory of truth, if making a truth claim leads you down a trajectory that ends in violence and extremism and terrorism, well, then you might think incoherence is a price worth paying. Even if you have to adopt an incoherent view, maybe it's just worth it. I think the amazing thing about Christianity is it refuses to let disagreement lead to devaluing. It's what we were just talking about. Jesus disagreed with us. His very coming was an act of disagreement with us. It was an act of saying that our lives have disagreed so strongly with what he intended for them that he had to come and give his life to save us. But that did not in any way lead to devaluing. At the cross, we have the greatest statement of Jesus' disagreement of us, but we also have the greatest statement of his valuing of us at the very same time. So in Christianity, you have both of these biblical claims that God is love, and then that God is truth. Jesus is the truth, John 14:6. If God is love and if God is truth, then love is truth. Those are one and the same. Love without truth is not love. Truth without love is not truth. Christianity refuses to make a choice between one or the other. It keeps those two together. And I think that right there is the gospel. So as a Christian, and for all the Christians listening, we need to find ways. What does it look like to act and to believe both in love and in truth, to act towards our neighbors where we're not making a decision between one or the other, but we're making that gospel decision to say, I am going to act in both love and in truth towards you at one and the same time.
So in this book, you've spent a lot of time, you and Ravi, you know, reviewing and helping us understand more about these isms, kind of the secular gods that rule much of our culture and society. But should we as Christians be spending our time understanding these worldviews, or is it more important that we, you know, like instead of looking at counterfeit bills, we look at real bills? Do we need to just study Christianity more deeply, and that will help us be able to fend off these counterfeits?
Yeah, that's a nice analogy. It's a really nice analogy. I think you're right. We need to focus first and foremost on the Christian faith. Someone once said there are two ways to choose a coat. You can examine its dimensions, or you can pick it up and you can try it on. I recommend both. You know, for me, I needed to examine some of the dimensions of Christianity and compare it and contrast with some of the dimensions of the other ways of seeing the world before I was even willing to take it seriously on a heart level. And so if we want to take people seriously, then we need to take their worldviews seriously, because we need to know what those intellectual obstacles are so that we can help to lovingly move them out of the way so that then they can consider Christianity in a more direct way. But that is the goal. Ultimately, we're not trying to do intellectual gymnastics. We're not dealing with philosophy just for the sake of philosophy. We're trying to introduce people to the person of Jesus. And one of the campuses I was on not long ago, there was one young man who journeyed with us throughout the week, a skeptic on Monday, asked his hard questions. We welcomed those questions. By Wednesday, he was forming friendships. He was sensing the love of God in the context of the Christian community. By Friday, he was ready to make a decision for Christ. He wanted to entrust his life to Jesus, and we had the incredible privilege of praying with him to do that. And when he opened his eyes, these were the very first words that came out of his mouth as a Christian. He said, I've always felt like I had to wear a mask, but now this is the first time in my life that I can be truly myself and fully alive. And no theory and no ism can do that. That sort of life transformation only Jesus can bring, because only Jesus makes truth personal in that sort of way.
You know, Vince, one of the chapters you deal with is hedonism, and I'm thinking, you know, that's affects all of us more than we realize. We live in a culture that's always asking, what's in it for me? How does the gospel come against that or play in that the cultural setting?
Yeah, and we have a model here. I'm so glad that Jesus wasn't a hedonist, because if he was, he never would have given his life for me. You think about him in the garden the night before he died, my heart is sorrowful even to death. You know, there's a significant sense in which that was not a decision that he made for the sake of his own pleasure. And then historically, I'm so glad the early church was not a group of hedonists, because the church never would have grown. We have these great records from the Emperor Julian in the 4th century, for instance, and he's complaining about the fact that he can't squash Christianity. And the reason he says he can't is because they care not only for their own poor, but even for our poor. And if you go back further in the history, you look at the Antonine and the Cyprian plagues in the first few centuries of Christianity, and Christians were the only ones who remained inside the city walls rather than literally fleeing for the hills in order to at many times give their lives in order to care for those who were sick. And so, you know, hedonism in that sense, in just the pursuit of pleasure, is in stark contrast to what we see in Jesus himself in the early church. I'm incredibly, incredibly thankful for that. You know, on the other hand, it's not that desires are a bad thing. We're given desires by God. Oftentimes, it's not that those desires are too strong. It's that they're too weak. C.S. Lewis said that. Augustine implied it as well. I always think of my brother. We were going to Disney World as a family. We had about 24 hours of delays for the flight, and by the time we got down there, we got off the plane, we got to baggage claim, and my young brother saw the revolving baggage claim equipment, and he thought it was Disney World, and he said, "Oh, Dad, thanks so much for bringing me to Disney World. I love Disney World." It wasn't that, you know, his desire was too strong. It was that it was too weak. He couldn't imagine how much more there could be. And so sometimes we need to pick up on people's desires and say, you know what, that's a good desire, but there's even more. You have that childlike desire for perfect love. You know what? You are perfectly loved. You have that childlike desire to never die. You know what? That's a true desire too. Billy Graham once said, "One day you'll hear rumors that I have died. Do not believe them. They will be true. They will not be true." What a wonderful thing to be able to say. And so sometimes we can identify people's desires and say the truest fulfillment of those desires are in Christ.
You're going to find great encouragement in Dr. Vince Vitale's new book, Jesus Among Secular Gods, The Countercultural Claims of Christ. He co-wrote it with Ravi Zacharias. Vince is director of the Zacharias Institute, Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, apologist and speaker. And we're honored, Vince, to have you with us today. Thank you for encouraging us and for being on the front lines and sharing these important claims of truth.
Well, it's my incredible privilege, and thanks, Neil. It's been a real encouragement to be on with you. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Dr. Vince Vitale joining us here on Connecting Faith. We're going to hear from Vince's boss, Ravi Zacharias. A couple of years ago, he was on the campus of the University of Northwestern. We had a chance to sit down in the studio and talk with him, and we'll share a portion of that just ahead. By the way, we do have a copy of Ravi and Vince's book, Jesus Among Secular Gods. We're giving it away at 877-933-2484. Drawing coming up for that, 877-93-FAITH. Here on Connecting Faith, we are honored to spend some time talking with Ravi Zacharias, who's president and founder of the Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, headquartered in Atlanta, and they have a global outreach. In fact, they have offices and speakers that travel the world, and Ravi does as much as any of them, but written a number of books. Of course, we hear him every day on Just Thinking on Faith Radio, and it's just an honor, Ravi, to have you with us here on campus.
Good to be with you. I tell you what, I can't tell you what year it was, but many, many years ago I was right here and did interviews. I think President Burson was here.
Burson was here
at that time, and I used to team up with him at Lake Okoboji in Iowa.
Yeah.
Those were the years that, time has gone by, but I remember being here.
you do have an opportunity to speak at a variety of places, right? Mostly, are they supportive, or do you sort of head into hostile environments, or is it becoming more hostile?
We do four venues. We do the academic, the political, the business, and the arts. We don't get into politics, but we deal with political leadership. In some academic settings, it's getting more and more adversarial. Quite fascinating, really. North America is one of the toughest places to even be given the freedom to speak. You know, you're starting to see people holding placards and all of that. I said, when I was speaking recently at an Ivy League school, which was packed to the hilt, a friend from Jakarta wrote to me and said, I want you to know I'll be thinking of you as you speak to a hostile American audience. I said, university. I said, my goodness, how times have changed. Because I spoke at the University of Jakarta, over 3,000 there. Nobody was holding placards. Nobody trying to describe me in terms that some people here would like to. Quite a fascinating time. It doesn't just blunt, it just saddens to see what we face. However, all said and done, when it's over, we do get some very, very positive responses, even from the audience that maybe were skeptical in the beginning.
Ravi, I know your ministry focus is so twofold, helping the thinker believe and helping the believer think. So I'm interested in maybe which part of that has been more effective, or maybe which part needs more propping up.
They're both tough. They're both tough, because to help the believer think is a tall order when you've got so many issues that test us in our thinking these days. And how does one get that into our churches, into our youth groups, into the arenas in which they come to listen to the proclamation of the gospel, to get them to think? So we do it in various ways. We'll do it through our writings. We'll do it through our web programs. We'll do it through our online offerings. We'll do it through DVDs and CDs. And we do, judging by the response we get and the letters we get, it has made a difference. So also in helping the thinker believe. We hear wonderful stories of people's lives being transformed. But it keeps us on our toes. We have to keep doing our homework. We cannot just sit back and say, the study is done. No, there's always a new issue to deal with, a new challenge to face. And I have about 30 to 40 other apologists globally on our team based in 10 countries. They say the same thing and they face the same challenges, but we are seeing huge impact. Our ministry was founded in 1984 and it has grown immensely.
Is the issue wrestling with truth still at the heart of it? Is there really truth, and does that shape and influence my worldview?
It's certainly one of the most cardinal issues to deal with, because we assume that truth is easily self-evident. But if you talk to the sciences, they have one way of coming to the truth. If you talk to the arts, they have another way, or sometimes don't even care about the truth. If you talk to they're spiritually minded, oftentimes it's mystical truth. So it's a case of how you approach your audience. But truth is what ultimately is the pursuit for every life. Yeah.
Ravi Zacharias, president and founder of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. You hear him daily on Just Thinking on Faith Radio. A couple of years ago, one of the books you wrote had an intriguing title, Has Christianity Failed You? I'd like to know why that topic. And was there a time where you thought it maybe had failed you personally?
To be honest with you, no. In my life, I hadn't sensed that, because of the nature of my coming to Christ, the setting in which I found Christ. But I had talked to so many people in my travels for whom there had been a struggle, either intellectual or emotional or doctrinal or something. They just found, as one young man said to me in Washington, he said, I just actually have one question for God. He said, why did you make it so difficult to believe in you? So I think he was an honest man, and he was trying to say, why is it so difficult? He said, nothing would thrill me more than to find out we are really the creation of a divine mind and a divine being. But I just find so much of conflict within me. So I think the Christian has to deal with this, what we call the hidden nature of God, or the hiddenness of God, and how we, what is the interplay between faith and reason? I've always said God has put enough into this world to make faith in him a most reasonable thing. He's left enough out to make it impossible to live by sheer reason alone. So this interplay between faith and reason is a critical aspect of answering questions on what the Christian faith is all about.
Well, and you used the word tension a while ago, that there is really maybe paradox and tension, but there's a lot of tension in play, isn't it, in today's world?
A lot of tension. You know, when you see the kind of suffering you often see, the pain, the sadness, the loneliness, the destitution, you do have to ask some tough questions. But you know, then I look at the Lord Jesus on his path to the cross, struggling himself at that point. You know, if there's any other way for this, can this cup be taken from me? Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. I look at it this way, Neil, very simply stated. Love is the greatest ethic. Where there is the possibility of love, there has to be the reality of freedom. Where there is the reality of freedom, there's going to be the possibility of pain. Where there is possibility of pain, there's going to be the need for a Savior. Where there's a need for a Savior, there has to be the provision of a Redeemer and redemption. So starting with love and freedom through pain, salvation, and the redemption, it is a comprehensive way of thinking in the Christian faith. The secular person actually stops right at the beginning. They don't even understand what freedom means. Do we really have freedom? And what does love mean? Who defines it? So the starting point stumps the naturalist. But the destination to which we go, the believer in Christ, I think, explains these concepts quite thoroughly.
Getting back to that starting point is, I guess, much of what you've been doing over the years, isn't it? To keep digging deeper and maybe peeling back our misunderstanding of worldview.
Yes, we've done that. I've been in the ministry now for 42 years. But in apologetic ministry itself, this is our 30th year. So 12 years prior to that, I was doing itinerant work and then a professorship in New York. And after that, went into start this ministry in Christian apologetics. We have our Oxford Center for Christian Apologetics now based in Oxford, UK. It's a very, very fine institution. And we have about 120, 130 full-time based in 10 countries. But our work is actually presenting the beauty and the credibility of the gospel. Apologetics is the seasoning so that it clears the bushes, that they can take a good look at the person of Christ.
Your wonderful radio program, Just Thinking, gives us an opportunity to hear some of those discussions and engage in that. Just say a word about, you've been involved in radio for most of that time,
yeah.
I think. Why radio?
We have two programs. One is a half-hour program in several stations called Let My People Think. And then we have a 15-minute program called Just Thinking. It's amazing stories that we hear. Amazing stories. I will get letters from people in China. I prefer radio to television, frankly, because television can seduce you into an image mode. Radio, the truth becomes supreme where the imagination is left to the listener. In television, you pretty much have to circumscribe the imagination too. So I'm much more of a radio person than a TV person. People use television very wisely. Some of them don't. I've stuck with radio, and we've done it for many years, and we've got a tremendous response from it over the years, unbelievable amount.
You made the comment in the message here on the campus of the university about, you know, people who listen with their eyes and think with their feelings. So talk a little bit about that, the world in which we live that's so so visually focused.
Yeah, all the way from news to entertainment, it's become the eye gate. You can see one picture on a television screen and 30 seconds of a context, and you think you now know the whole story. It's simply not true. I've been in places where those issues are shown on the screen, and I say to myself, how did it get so distorted by this medium here or by whoever wanted to tell the story? See, the danger is in the news is a person trying to get you to a certain belief and therefore will use any means to get you there? Or is it to give you the facts and let you get to whatever you choose to believe there? That's the first thing. The second thing is in entertainment. The eyes can be very deceptive, can distort reality, make you think it is what it is actually not. And so I think we are in a very vulnerable medium. Now, it's a beautiful medium. I mean, who would not like to sit in front of the television and watch a beautiful representation from National Geographic programs or even watch the Olympics or something? There's an advantage. But with every such medium comes responsibility. And I'm not sure I trust humanity to have that responsibility anymore.
Robbie Zacharias, some comments from a campus visit here a couple of years ago. Glad to share it with you. You can hear that full conversation or the full conversation today with Vince Vitale on our website, myfaithradio.com. Go to the Connecting Faith show page. Tomorrow on Connecting Faith, Jeff Mannion. Oh, help us stay faithful day by day. And don't forget to sign up for the Priceless Movie DVD giveaway. Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support, and you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.